I have a question for Kristen, I guess, and also for Larry. Terry Gastrolinum here, kind of toward the back, yeah. It strikes me that you are able to make iPS cells that recapitulate some of the gene expression in neurons. To what extent do you think this, the low-hanging fruit here, may be early detection of disease, taking people who may be predisposed to disease and actually establishing early on that they have it, and even following their progression through skin cell assays instead of through brain biopsies? And then there are other tissues that are less accessible as well. Eyeballs, for example. So glaucoma is a degenerative disease that's very hard to detect early on.
Go ahead.
So
I'll follow up.
I'm working not just on schizophrenia, but autism too. And I actually talked about this with a friend of mine. He got really excited till I pointed out that autism happens at like a year and a half of age and takes me like a year and a half for this experiment. So I'm going to predict nothing. I think I have a chance with schizophrenics. I could probably beat them to like 17 years and maybe no. But until we really have drugs and treatments, like the psychiatric diseases, there's almost nothing we can do to prevent it even if we knew it was coming. So I think, at least in my eyes, for psychiatric disease, going after screening for drugs and molecules that could maybe prevent any phenotypes is maybe where to start.
You know, I think with AD, we have a longer timeline within which to work, so that's the good news. And I think the answer to your question will depend upon whether in the sporadic AD cell lines, if those lines do recapitulate the sorts of changes we see in familial lines, be they transcriptional or processing or some other phenotype, and it's missing in the controls, then yes, it could become a diagnostic. But at that point, I think we'll be in the same boat that Kristen just noted, which is in that this is the problem in Huntington's disease. The diagnostic tests are pretty good, but we can't do much about it. So unless we develop effective therapeutics, I'm not sure that it's going to be all that helpful. But that will be a personal decision.
Okay, so I have almost the reverse question, which is these diseases which arise late in life, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, schizophrenia even, for some reason they don't affect neurons until you're 17 or 70. How might we figure out soon whether iPS cell-derived neurons are going to follow that same time course, or whether there's a way, whether they will spontaneously get disease, or whether there's a way to make it go faster? And do you have any data that
Larry speak to the death phenotype, but schizophrenia, the doctors are starting to realize it's diagnosed as schizophrenia at age 17 or 18, but there's early developmental defects that appear at 3 or 4 years of age. So schizophrenia might actually be like a neuromaturation phenotype, something that we might be able to see. It takes 17 years for the brain wiring to go wrong, but the neurons themselves might actually have defects much earlier. But that's a completely different question than a degenerative disease.
Yeah, so this question does come up on occasion. My answer is that if you look in animal models that contain these kinds of mutations, either fruit flies or mice, they develop very significant phenotypes in a few days to a few months at the cellular level in those systems. So if the human neurons in culture behave like what we've seen in animal models, then time may not be such a factor. I think a second argument is probably that we know from most of the neurodegenerative diseases that people don't become phenotypic, you know, cognitively demented or Parkinsonian or showing weakness in the case of ALS until large numbers of neurons have been lost and are dead. And so probably the initial phenotype has started much, much earlier, and it may be that the assays in culture will pick that up. But I think, you know, we have to see. We see hints that this may be true, but until we do the experiments and get the data, it's supposition.
It's regarded that human ESLs are closer to epi stem cells. And do you see a difference? Because you showed some really classical differences depending on whether it was epiblast or cell mass.
So there's a lot of data that the existing human ESLs are more similar to epiblast stem cells. I think that in the view of our data and experiments, it would be worth to try to establish de novo human ESLs in the presence of the Wnt protein to see whether we can block them early enough to have them in the state that is equivalent to the mouse, the bona fide mouse ESL pluripotent state. And that is something that we're now embarking on doing, actually, to make de novo human ESLs that are potentially more similar to what people call mouse embryonic stem cells.
That is probably very important. And I think they can make iPS cells, too, really bend one way or the other. And
that's exactly what we're trying to do, with support from CIRM, actually, just as you know.
yeah, great place. Sorry, Kat.
Sorry. Speaking of making iPS cells bend, what about the genes that we're adding and the reprogramming that we're doing, whether it's oncogenic or not? You brought up the genomic instability, Larry, of the iPS cells that are being made. How do you see us safeguarding against those events, and how do you see the therapeutic implications of this, or the therapeutic application, rather, of iPS technology?
Yeah, I think that at the end of the day, Evan may have more to add to this, but I think that no matter what you do to cells that have been extensively manipulated in culture, you're going to worry that they changed somehow, that they picked up mutations, or that you selected for variants, whether you use viruses, which have more of a concern, or plasmid-based or protein-based or whatever. And I think, ultimately it's going to come back to objective experimental measurements of safety as opposed to supposition from blackboard theory. I think it's going to be an empirical issue.
I mean, how homogeneous were you talking about homogeneity? I mean, Raul just told us it depends on maybe how you make your stem cells. You're going to get a difference. I mean, how homogeneous is it necessary? Just to show the phenotype? Repeatedly show the phenotype? How do you make a judgment on your homogeneity?
Well, I think if you're talking about purifying cells to set up cultures of defined composition, I presume we're talking 90 to 95%. If you're talking clinical application, I have no idea. Because I think, you get in, is 1 in 1,000 okay? Is 1 in 10,000 okay? I think this is, again, where there are standard animal models for tumorigenicity, and we are going to be relying on data from those standard models to tell us whether that level of there's always going to be a level of contamination. And sure. So that's part of the risk-benefit calculation.
So Carl Willett has a mic.
Yeah, I had a question for Raul. So you showed that you could block, over here, you could block the transition from stem cell to epiblast by inhibiting Wnt. What about the reverse? There was a paper recently where they made stem cells, embryonic stem cells from epiblast by simply adding LIF in the case of the mouse.
Yeah, many experiments that other people have done were in more complex media, serum, feeder cells, and then adding LIF. What we are doing is just playing with two different defined factors. And I think that it explains a lot of the discrepancies between what I've been showing today and what is published, including that study that you are referring to.
Well, so, as a follow-up, so it looks like simply by adding a single protein, like in this case LIF, you can push an epiblast back to an embryonic stem cell.
In the context of other factors.
What about taking it further up the line? How far back before you have to start introducing four transcription factors to reprogram?
Yeah, that will be very interesting indeed to push the generation of the most primitive cells with just outside factors.